Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Fish, Frankie, and fire prevention is what we have for you today. At 9:30, I'll be hanging out with WDEV All-Star Frankie Allen. And then we'll discuss important steps to prevent the many fires we are seeing this winter and most winters. And then we finish with a free-for-all as we open up the phones. But let's start with fish and fresh seafood. I was tipped off by a friend in the Valley, Anne-Marie Fury, who runs Product Think Tank, that Sugarfish was an amazing place to get your seafood. As she put it, their fish is fantastic and their calamari is never rubbery. We're going to learn about their seafood and their other two businesses. Joining me is Susie Edwards. Good morning, Susie.
Good morning.
And we also have Bob Edwards, known in some circles as the Skipper. Bob, welcome to you as well.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good, good. Listeners, if you want to ask our guests about Sugarfish, or if you've had the seafood, you want to dish on the fish, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Okay. First of all, Susie, what? Tell us about, or I'm sorry, Bob, let's start with Bob. Tell us about your background in the fishing business.
Well, I actually jumped on a fishing boat right out of high school. It's been a long time. It's been 44 years now I've been in the industry. I've owned multiple boats. We currently own two boats now that fish out of New Bedford, Massachusetts. So we're actively in the industry and catching some of our own product we sell in Sugarfish.
Oh, that's outstanding. And Susie, you're of the sea as well. So what's your sailing background?
I'm a competitive dinghy sailor, have been for many years, competing in events nationally and mostly up and down the eastern seaboard on a 17-foot boat called the Thistle. And it's a little more difficult, challenging for me now that I'm in Vermont to participate like I used to. But I did that for many years.
Well, how do you reach that level to be competing on, you know, at the national level?
It's a lot easier than you might think. really just showing up and putting in the time, learning and jumping on boats with a lot of different people, and you just get with a team and start a campaign and train like any other sport.
Yeah. Well, Bob, how much fishing can be done at this time of year?
Well, believe it or not, we fish year-round. In the wintertime, it definitely is a little more challenging, you know. It seems like we get the big snowstorms. I hear all the stories about the fresh powder, and all I do is get 20 or 30-foot seas offshore.
Oh, man.
So it has its challenges, but also when the weather's rough, the prices are higher. So, you know, we have two big boats. One's 98 feet, and the other's 105. So sometimes we're kind of – we have to put the weather in, and it just – it all works out at the end of the day.
Now, I work in an office, and I have problems with my hands when I go out and have to scrape, you know, the car windows, Bob. So what about your hands? What do you use on them to keep them, you know, from cracking, to keep them soft and supple?
You know, I over the years, I've used a product from Young Living Essential Oil Company called Animal Sense, mm-hmm. or I've used Bag Bomb in the past. You know, what they use for chapped and cows' udders. People in Vermont can appreciate Bag Bomb, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
But that's where it really gets tough, is when you got to go out and mend the net in this kind of weather. And you really can't wear gloves because you're pinching the twine to sew your knots. And that's the worst part about it this time of year.
Yeah. Susie, do you go out on those boats, or do you stick to just the sailboats?
I actually went on my first trip during summer, and it was quite an experience.
I
enjoyed it.
Well, what do you love about seafood, Susie?
I love learning the different ways to prepare it and cook it. Before I met Bob, I was a little intimidated by cooking seafood because I didn't have that much experience. And so just having access to good seafood, and Bob knows quite a bit about how to prepare it, and that knowledge has transferred to me. And so now I'm much more comfortable cooking it in lots of different preparations, and I like experimenting with different recipes.
What's your favorite catch there, Susie?
Norwegian haddock is probably my go-to fish when I want something easy and good and works well with a lot of different preparations.
Now, Bob, as Susie mentioned, sailing, especially like she does, Vermont, not the greatest place for it. Fishing like you do, again, not a big call for it in Vermont. So what got you to Vermont?
Well, honestly, what got me to Vermont was I wanted to be an ambassador. My daughter was going to Kimball Union High School down in Meriden, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking at ski areas where I could become an ambassador. And friends that I skied with told me, if you want to be an ambassador, you got to go to Sugar Bush. And needless to say, after a few phone calls, one thing led to another. I'm still very good friends with the guest service manager who's retired now from Sugar Bush. And we've been in the valley for 13 years.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right. So, Susie, then how did sugarfish become a thing?
It was something that there's a place in Connecticut called, it's Bombsters at the time in Stonington. And they basically had a freezer on their, outside their store with a credit card machine that was available 24/7 for people to come in or buy fish. And so Bob and I were trying to conceive something like that in Vermont where we could bring up a variety of fish at a low price and make it available in a similar way. And so we started down that path, and then I left the corporate world and had a lot more time on my hands. And so we decided to jump in with both feet, and we do have an On Your Honor service element to our store, but we also have a larger space that's available when we're there to man it.
And what do you sell at the shop?
We have, I'd say, over 45 different varieties of seafood. We have salmon, sea bass, shrimp, scallops, halibut, haddock, wing, cod, tuna, sword, flounder.
We've got a little bit of everything.
Yeah. And what comes right from Bob's ship?
We catch the redfish.
Mm-hmm.
We catch some domestic haddock. A whiting, which is, it's a fish about the size of a brook trout, but a little more round. It's very ethnic. We ship a lot of that to New York City.
Mm.
And calamari is one of our major staples on the boats.
That's outstanding. And then, Bob, where else do you source seafood from?
I have a company that I've been friends with and doing business with down here in New Bedford called Pier Fish. And also another company in Stonington, Connecticut, Seawell Seafood. So both those companies have been, really on the cutting edge of quality and freshness and guidelines in their plants to be ahead of the curve. And we pride ourselves on educating people that, don't get rid of the mystique that a frozen piece of fish is no good, because a lot of fish you get everywhere, it has been previously frozen. And when you flash freeze a piece of fish at the height of its freshness, it can't, it doesn't go bad anymore. So
right.
It's we try to educate people on that concept. And when they get in and try our product, they start to learn the benefits of frozen seafood.
Yeah. When you flash freeze it, because there's nothing, is there, like that fish that you catch and cook that day. But if you flash freeze it, you kind of lock that in, don't you, Bob?
Yes, you do. And when you flash freeze it, typically it's a 40 below zero plate or blast tunnel that freezes it at that pace. It freezes so quick you don't get the cellular degeneration in the product. I explain it to people. It's like when your pipes freeze in the house, they slowly freeze and expand and burst. That's why if you put a piece of fish or meat in your freezer and you see those little icicles coming off of it, that's because it froze slow and it squeezed the moisture out of it. But when you blast freeze, you don't get that, that bleeding of moisture.
Yeah.
And you got a great product.
Let's take a call from Forbes. Morning, Forbes.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Fishing industry. I was born in Portland, Maine, and my dad insured a lot of the commercial fishermen. From the Grand Banks to Gloucester. So I grew up in that industry.
Yeah.
And nothing like the North Atlantic in the middle of the winter, chopping ice off the rigs with a fire axe to keep them sinking. But anyway, I had something I think everybody should know, and that is when you go into a store and you look at seafood, it's marked farm-raised or wild caught.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a good explanation of that is probably in order.
I agree. Thanks, Forbes. Bob, first of all, where do you fish out of?
Our dock is located in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah.
We've been established here for a little over 20 years now.
That's a great town, neat whaling museum.
I'm sorry, what's that?
I said great town, neat whaling museum down there.
It's awesome whaling museum. Yeah, it's a great town. They're doing a lot of work around here to make it nicer and more tourist attractive to learn about the fishing industry.
Yeah.
But our range would go anywhere from as far south as Virginia to what we call the Hague Line. It's an imaginary border between Canada and the U.S., which is about 150 miles east of Cape Cod. So that's pretty much our range. We've got a pretty wide range depending on what we're chasing.
And then to address Forbes's question, the difference between farm-raised and wild-caught.
Well, farm raised is kind of what you would think. It's a controlled environment where they'll raise fish, you know, from spawn. Where wild caught is something that we would catch, out in the ocean with either nets or hooks. And there's a lot of stigma around farm raised. You know, it's just like anything. There's some really high quality farm raised products. And there's some really bad farm-raised products, so you have to be mindful of it. You know, unfortunately, in the industry, the world demands for fish leaves us in a place where we have to raise some of the seafood that we eat. And, as long as, like it's in Norway, for example, you know, they have very strict guidelines, and we do carry some farm-raised Norwegian salmon. But it's all in open fikes, in the fjords, and they have very, very strict guidelines.
Oh, interesting. Now, Susie, in addition to at your shop, Sugarfish in Waitsfield, where else can people find your fish?
Also at Paradise Provisions on the Sugarbush Access Road in Warren.
All right. Now, there are recipes on your website that are killer. Susie, any faves that you have?
I've made all of them. Most of them have been given to me by friends, and I encourage people all the time if they have really good recipes to submit them to me, and I'll put them up on the website with credit.
I can't wait to try Annie's fabulous fish stew, which sounds absolutely amazing. Skipper, tell us how to make grilled swordfish just right.
Grilled swordfish. Yeah, I was introduced to a recipe using mayonnaise, dill weed, a little bit of garlic powder, and lemon juice. And now I'm a guy that can't even have a spot of mayonnaise on a sandwich, but I could not eat my swordfish without it. So you put the mayonnaise in a little cup, and you add lemon juice so it just thins it out a little bit. You don't want it watery.
Right.
And then it's a pinch of dill and a sprinkle of garlic powder, and I paste it on the swordfish on one side and put it on the hot grill, and then I don't turn it. I watch the swordfish, and as the outer edge goes from an opaque color to more of a white color, I'll put a little bit of the mayonnaise on that upside and flip it over. And I always cook it with the grill open, never with the grill closed.
Gotcha.
And just flip it once, and you'll have some of the best moist swordfish you've ever had.
Oh, and swordfish is absolutely delicious. What a wonderful fish right there to eat. All right, let's move on to scallywags. And Susie, tell us what scallywags is.
The scallywags is dog treats or pet treats that cats like them too. And it's dehydrated seafood that comes right off Bob's fishing boat, except for cod skins, which we source from Alaskan fishermen.
And who came up with this brilliant idea to, you know, to have a seafood store and then segue into pet treats?
It sort of was the genesis of like two dog loving folks who wanted to create pet treats.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say it was an original idea with the cod skins, which is what we started with, but we chose that because it was already in the marketplace and people were familiar with it, and we were able to source it pretty easily. So we started with that just around the Mad River Valley, and it we were encouraged by how people took to it and liked it. So then he said, "Well, why don't we just use fish off my boat?" So he thought dogfish would be an excellent choice to dehydrate because you can slice them into like almost cookie shapes. And we also use squid off his boat. And I should also mention the dogfish is a bycatch. It's considered a trash fish. There's no human or pet market for it, so it just gets run overboard when he catches it. So we thought, and you know, try to eliminate this waste stream by turning it into some sort of a pet treat.
Oh, I love it.
The squid is it's a catch for all the time. It's primary fishery. So we thought, why we could just slice this up and call it calabarky instead of calamari. And it's probably the one that's the most pungent to the human, but the dogs go crazy for it.
Wow. Well, Bob, I know cats, you know, and fish, that's a natural, but, how, you know, dogs eating fish, that they love it too?
They do, you know. I mean, they're high in omega-3s, and, you know, they're a great source of protein. So, you know, I being on the boat, I've always had a dog that goes with me on the boat. So, you know, and they can eat the raw fish, bones and all, as long as it hasn't been cooked, where the bones don't get brittle.
Oh, right.
And dehydrating it, just, you know, the products we dehydrate, the cartilage are very fine bones, and once they're dehydrated, they just crunch them right up.
Yeah. Wow. All right. And, Susie, where can people find these treats for their pooches?
We are scattered all over the Mad River Valley. Pet Food Warehouse, both stores carry our product and distribute for us.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the, you know, if you're up in the Burlington area, that would be the place to go, or
all
some
right.
of the local pet stores in that area.
All right. And it's called Scallywags. Now, Bob, I want to get to one more part of your empire. We're running out of time. Tell us about the laundromat.
The laundromat. That's just kind of a funny story. People ask us all the time, you know, why do you have a fish store and a laundromat? And we kind of joke and tell them we got the cleanest fish in town. But, you know, I'm a tinkerer. I like to work with my hands. And when I first came to the Valley, I tracked the owner down of this laundromat and told him, when he sells, I want to buy. So don't call the realtor, call me. And every year I would come back and give him a card and tell him the same thing. And then when the fish store came to a thought in our mind, we knew there was a space in the laundromat that was a dry cleaner. And it just seemed like the logical chain of events to use that space. And it was a great location, and it morphed into, we just finally closed in December, and now we're proud owners. We're the king and queen of coin op, as well as our fish and dog treats, all in one building.
It reminds me of a place in Cincinnati. It was a rock and roll venue, and they had it was a laundromat in there too. It was called Sudsy Malone's, and you know, it didn't seem to make sense to anybody, but touring bands absolutely loved. There was a venue there and across the street, and they loved when they got to Cincinnati because they could wash their clothes in this bar and have a beer.
Great.
Yeah. So, all right. The king and queen of coin op, but also wonderful fish and pet treats as well. Susie and Bob Edwards are the owners of Sugarfish, Scallywags, and the Waitsfield Laundromat, and you can learn more at sugarfishvt.com and at scallywagsvt.com. I want to thank you both for being on the show this morning.
Thank you, Rick, for having us.
All right, that Enjoyed was a lot of fun. Yep, so did I. All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to come back to visit with WDEV All-Star Frankie Allen. And coming up today at 1, it's 3 full hours of The Getaway with Senior Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Time to spend a little more time celebrating WDEV's 90th anniversary by meeting another WDEV All-Star. And although he has not been with the station for 90 years, people in these parts say that our next guest put in about that amount of time since he started working for the Radio Vermont Group. He's another of our five-tool players with a whole lot of skills. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present Frankie Allen. Frankie, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Wow, Rick, that's quite the introduction. Thank you. I'm just so happy I didn't have to follow the cartoon segment yesterday.
That's right. That would have been very difficult.
Does anybody remember the banana splits?
Oh, yes, of course. Flegel. Let's see. There was Flegel and who else? I love those guys. They were a lot of fun.
I figured you would name them.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Sid and Marty Croft had all that going on with Lidsville and H.R. Puff and stuff and the banana splits, I think.
Yeah.
All those kind of furry animal things going on. Yeah.
And there was the music, tra-la-la song, you know?
Yeah, tra-la-la, la-la-la-la. If you ever listen to the song Buffalo Soldier by Bob Marley, there's a riff in the middle of it that sounds like you know, one came from the other. I don't know who stole from who, but every time
I think he used to be able to get the records on the back of cereal boxes. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah, that's right. You'd cut them out and you put them on your. Oh my goodness! Yeah, that was high quality.
Yeah, there you go. How things have changed, huh?
Oh my goodness, that's wild. Oh, well done, Frankie. All right. If you want to have a question for Frankie or one about Frankie, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Frankie, where are you from originally?
Originally from Scranton, Pennsylvania, Rick.
Yeah. Well, then let's talk food right off the bat. What can you tell us?
I was just going to say, when you and I get together, it's about a six-hour food conversation.
That's right. What can you tell people about something I only learned about a little over a year ago, Old Forge-style pizza?
Well, you see, Old Ford style pizza, that region had its own way of making pizza, and it wasn't made with mozzarella cheese. It was made with American cheese, and it wasn't round. It was cut like in squares. So, and all the pizza places in Scranton, around Scranton, Old Ford, wherever it was, Dunmore, PA, they would all make, and they were all, you know, family owned pizza shops. You know, there was Maroni's and, Giarelli's, and there were all these local pizza places, and they all made the pizza the same way. So it was just part of the growing up and part of the region of the Scranton region, Old Ford style pizza.
Now, you talk in the past tense, but if you go back there, it's still there, right? They're still...
Oh, it's still there.
Yeah.
I visit. I have family there, so I have brothers that still live in the area. So it's a nice throwback. There's family-owned places, old Italian markets that are now third-generation owned, and old diners that have been around since the 1920s, like the Keystone Diner.
Oh, wow.
Texas hamburgers and Texas wieners, as they call them there.
Yep.
And they're all still there. So, yeah, it's kind of a neat place to go back and visit and be part of your childhood.
Absolutely. All right, so we're both from Pennsylvania. Frankie, I graduated from the Connecticut School of Broadcasting. It later became the Ohio Center of Broadcasting. You, where did you graduate from?
I went to a local college first, the University of Scranton, and got involved in the radio station there for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to broadcasting school out in Connecticut. It was the Connecticut School of Broadcasting.
Yep.
And they had, I think they had a school in Florida, and they had one in Connecticut. They might have had one other one somewhere
else. Well, that's the one I went to, Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, okay. Yep. So, yeah, I ended up going to the Connecticut School
of
Broadcasting, and that was in Farmington, Connecticut.
Now, where did that lead, Frankie, in the radio biz?
Well, that led, to my first job. I mean, you were taught by, as you know, you were taught by people in the business, and it was, concentrating on all aspects of radio. And they basically would help you put together a demo tape, and they would help you farm those demo tapes out. And I got a job, back in Scranton, which it's kind of ironic, Rick, because at the time, ESPN was starting. And the school was the next, ESPN was in Bristol, Connecticut, and the school was just a town over in Farmington. So, at the time, who would have thought that ESPN would have became what it is now,
Right.
I could have got on the ground level of that maybe at some point if I stayed in Connecticut. But, radio was my passion. I wanted to get into radio, and I took the first job available, and that was in a little town called Canton, PA, which was close to Elmira, New York, and close to Williamsport, PA, where they have the Little League World Series.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was a short gig. I was only there. I did weekends, but it got my foot in the radio, and then I ended up going back to Scranton, where I'm from, and actually my brother had a friend who was in radio, worked at WSCR. It was a standalone AM station in Scranton, and similar to WDEV, not as community oriented as DEV, but still we did a lot of local sports. Local high school football was big there. Local high school basketball. We ran University of Scranton basketball games in college. We did some pro stuff. We ran the Philadelphia Flyers hockey games. So it was sports related. It was called Full Service Radio. And that was back in 85, I think I was there, 85, 84, 85.
Wow.
So that's where I kind of cut my teeth on radio.
And then how did we get you? What got you started here at the Radio Vermont career?
Well, Radio Vermont, I came to Vermont with another radio company. It was called Sage Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
And when WSCR was sold, there was a startup station coming to Scranton, and it was going to be at the base of Montage Mountain, which may sound familiar to some people around here. That's where they have the Peach Festival now, Montage Mountain. It was a little ski area. It's big now. It's grown. I mean, I think the Yankees farm team plays there.
Oh, right.
There's a big baseball stadium there, too.
Yep.
So I came to Vermont via Sage Broadcasting. They had bought a whole bunch of stations up in the 80s. I worked for the one in Scranton. As I was with the company a few years, they started to move me around a little bit, and I would sort of go and help the program director set up the music format, because they would buy radio stations in small and medium markets, and they would upgrade the signal to be part of the, you know, the major market in that region. And, you know, there was usually a format change and usually a call letter change, and they would upgrade the signal. So I moved around a little bit for them, worked in Amsterdam and Albany, New York, and then they bought the radio station in Stowe, which was WRFB,
right,
which was where Roland LaJoy was working.
That's
right. He was
the
morning guy there.
Yeah.
So they bought that. I think it was 1989 is when I moved up to Vermont. And I was hired to do afternoons at WRFB and help out with the transition when they were ready. And it was about a year later, we moved the studios to the Red Barn Shops, and we changed the call letters to WVMX. And I was hired as the music director there. They had a general manager that was a company guy that came in from New Hampshire, I think he was, and Doug Shackett was his name, and Paul Mitchell was the PD. He came from another market. They stayed about a year, and then they promoted me to program director, and I stayed with Sage until Ken Squire bought the station in 1997. So I came through Sage Broadcasting in 1989 to Vermont.
Gotcha. So tell us what different positions you've held here with Radio Vermont.
Well, when Ken bought the radio station, it was WVMX, and the plan was to go with a classical format. And again, we were going to, you know, upgrade equipment. So I was retained. There was about three of us that were retained from the WVMX days because I had a little bit of computer experience and with music software and, you know, audio storage units, things like that running off computer. We were going to run commercials for WCVT. Was going to be the call letters, which it is still now.
Yep.
And it was a classical format, and we were going to run commercials off computer, which was really, I think, the first time that the Radio Vermont group was going to adventure into that because we were still running carts.
Yeah.
Everything was still analog.
So let's tell people what carts were. Carts are like the old 8-tracks, if you remember those, that you'd pop in your car. That was kind of the way carts were, and they would – play like a 30-second commercial and then stop and be queued for the next one. But they were old, like, big,
right, so
clunky.
They were, everything was analog. They were yep, tape, and you would play them off a cart machine.
Yep.
And, you know, WCBT was going to play their commercials off a computer.
Wow.
So I was sort
yes,
of
I'm so sorry about the wait, ma'am. I'll be...
I was sort of tasked with, you know, learning the computer and teaching the folks how to use it. And it was the Audio Vault system. It was the AV90, which was made by Broadcast Electronics. So I was hired as the operations manager for WCVT. That was my main priority for the Radio Vermont group at the time. And then eventually the studios were still at the Red Barn Shops, but we moved them down to WDEV,
mm-hmm,
and they built a studio for WCVT, which is now across the hall.
Yep, we got
WDEV. Yeah, that was the record library, by the way.
Oh, really? We've got Zeb Norris locked in there every morning. So
that was the old record library, and that was a project because we had to have a group of us, you know, carry all those records down into the basement, and then they had to build a studio for WCVT. But I was the behind the scenes guy. I didn't do any shows for WCVT. Brian Harwood was our morning announcer, and then I would set the computer up to run the commercials and to load in any short form or long form programs that we carried, any local programming that we carried along the way. We had some weekend shows that were local, so I basically did that in the beginning for the group. And,
all right, hold it right there, and we're going to take a break, and we'll come back and pick up your career. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. There is Frankie Allen, retired basketball coach at Virginia Tech and Maryland Eastern Shore. There's Frankie Allen, known as the UK's most feared comedian, but we're spending time with WDEV All-Star Frankie Allen this morning, who is equal parts of the other two Frankie Allens and so much more. He's with me until 10, so to ask Frankie a question... Frankie, if you need me to go out like as your warm-up act and get people excited for you, you just let me know. You can call
I'll
us.
I'll do that.
All right, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. All right, so let's pick up your career with Radio Vermont Group. You were at WCVT.
Right. So when I was in the WDEV building there, since we had the studios there, I was available to do some other things, and the general manager and vice president, Eric Michaels, at the time, got me involved in the other properties. They had WLVB and, of course, WDEV. So I started to, do on-air for WDEV, and I slowly became everybody's backup. I mean, Jack Donovan was our program director, and when he took vacation, I would fill in and do his show for the week. I'd come up to WLVB when Roland needed time off, and I'd do his show on the country station for the week. And, you know, I would fill in for production, Amy McGovern. God bless her. She was our production person, and I'd fill in for her and record clients for the week and do production for the group. So I sort of became a utility guy and a floater for the radio station over the years.
And now what are you doing with Radio Vermont?
Well, I was up here from 2010 to 2014 for on air, and then we started 101 The One in 2014, and I did that till 2019, and then one of our senior sales folks retired, Mark Strusacker. He retired and moved out to Wyoming, and Steve Cormier, the GM, asked if I'd like to get into sales, and I thought, you know what? I've done programming. I've been on the air for 30 plus years, pretty much, have done everything I wanted to. I mean, I've started stations from scratch and done multiple formats on the air. And I kind of felt like I had done everything in the programming side. So I accepted the job, and so glad that they had the confidence in me to do the sales side. So I've kind of been on all departments and on all sides of the glass, Rick.
Yeah. Now, Frankie, that's a completely different skill set for you, So how do you enjoy doing what you're doing now?
Well, I enjoy it. I think I'm lucky that I was on the air for so many years in the same market for so many years, because a lot of the folks already kind of knew me.
Yeah.
I had met them through recording them if I was, filling in for production. I had met them at live remotes and events. They had recognized me from being on the air over the years. So the transition, as far as me, wasn't a problem. I mean, I've been with the Radio Vermont Group now, and I'm going into my 25th year.
Wow.
I know the operations of all the radio stations. I know the audiences because I was on the air on all the radio stations. I kind of know the group really well. So the sales transition wasn't that hard.
Yeah.
For me. I mean, it's still a hard job because you got to go out and you got to talk to people face to face, but that's not a problem for me because I think my air work, kind of took care of all that.
Yeah, nicely done. So yeah. If you weren't in radio, Frankie, what would you'd have done as a career?
Well, that's the problem, Rick. I don't think there's anything else. I mean, I knew I needed to get near music and be near music or be near, be in a radio station. That was my passion. So, and I think about that all the time. I mean, I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I went to school for communications. Who knows? I mean, the alternative to me was like, I don't want to do anything else. I just want to do radio.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been some form of, media. But, I've been in radio since I was 22 years old and have never left the business. I mean, I've been in it for now 37 years straight.
Mm. Wow, that is fantastic. Who's the most interesting person you've met in radio or interviewed?
Wow. Most interesting person. That's a good question.
Have you ever met an interesting person in radio? Maybe that was the better question.
I was going to say Rich Sengary.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Checks in the mail.
I think, it was kind of cool to meet some of the celebrities. I met Carlos Santana.
Whoa.
It was pre-Radio Vermont Group, but, I had met him and interviewed him at the Top Notch Hotel. Eddie Money.
Oh, yeah.
He was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Early on in my career, and I don't even know if many people are even going to know who this person is. They might know him. Tiny Tim.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so nervous because it was my first interview when I was like 22 years old, and I didn't know what to ask the guy. But that was kind of a strange interview.
Mm-hmm. Played the ukulele, was on Rowan and Martin's Laughing. Back in the day, he used to play the same club in New York City with Bob Dylan. The two of them used to hang out together, eat burgers in the back room.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I did interview, you know, the farm show. We would go to the farm show every year. We would broadcast for the radio group. And I did interview a woman with a duck, the Aflac duck, it looked like. And that was quite an interview. I mean, she came over to the booth with the duck, and the duck started getting a little rambunctious and started, you know, leaning toward me and snapping at the microphone. And I thought the thing was going to take my nose off. So that was...
Dangerous from Frankie's dangerous moments in radio.
Yeah. Llama pick at the back of my pocket. There was something back there it wanted, and I was trying to conduct an interview, and I don't know what was going on back there, but that was a little nerve wracking.
And I know you go back to Scranton, go back and see the family, but when you get away from Vermont, where else do you like to travel?
I've been to the Caribbean quite a few times, but I like New England. I've been to Maine. I like Maine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of stuck in New England a little bit, to be honest with you, Rick. I would like to travel a little bit more and see more of the United States. I've got the music cities on my list that I like to see, Nashville and Memphis and Detroit, and, you know, see all the music cities. I've been to Cleveland and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I tend to stay close to New England. Every once in a while, I'll venture out and go to the Caribbean, but I like New England. I like it.
Well done. And how about in Vermont? Is there a place you like to sneak off to, either for some good food or some peaceful, you know, getaway time?
Well, I don't know how peaceful it is. I spend a lot of time in Stowe. I mean, the radio station was there for, you know, from 1989 to 97. So, you know, and I lived in Stowe. I've made a lot of good friends there. You know, there's a lot of good restaurants there, a lot of good people across the state of Vermont, but I tend to gravitate toward the resort towns, whether it's, you know, Smugglers or Stowe or, you know, Waitsfield, Warren, Sugarbush, those kinds of places. I know there's something fun. There's something about being in a resort town. Now, you're kind of and when you're on the radio, local radio stations, you're kind of a big fish.
Yeah.
You know, in a small pond kind of thing.
Yep.
And everybody gets to kind of know you, you know, and it's kind of a neat feeling.
Yeah. Frankie Allen's email address, appropriately, is fallen@radiovermont.com.
Yeah.
Hold him up. Help him up, folks. Write to him sometime. FAllen@radiovermont.com. Frankie, you're a real all-star. I want to thank you for being on this morning.
I appreciate it, Rick. Thank you so much. Love the show, and just love being part of the Radio Vermont group. It's great.
You would have done well even after the cartoon show. All right, let's take a break for a top-of-the-hour CBS News update, and then we'll spend some time discussing fire prevention. And a reminder that coming up this morning at 11, Common Sense Radio, and that's followed by the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. We never seem to make it through the winter in Vermont without losing houses and barns to fire. Last week, the Percy Farm in Stowe lost a barn and 100 cows. The next night in Alberg, 20 animals, horses, cows, lambs, and chickens were killed in another barn fire. Why do these fires happen so often in the winter, and what can we do to prevent them? Joining me now to discuss these issues is Williston Fire Department Fire Captain Prescott Natto. Prescott, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Listeners, to ask Prescott about what steps you can take to prevent fires in your home or barn, you can call us at 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255 or email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Prescott, does it feel like there's more of these barn and house fires during the winter, or is it an actual fact? Do we actually see a spike at this time of year?
So statistically speaking, there is indeed a spike in fires nationally during the winter months. But what I can tell you just from your intro and even our experience locally in the Williston Fire Department is that fires in the state of Vermont seem to be up more this year. Statistically, we'll wait until the quarter one closes out to find out exactly where we fall based on the past few years. But nationwide, winter does prove to be an increased fire season.
And why is that? Do we know why?
I think a lot of it stems from the fact that, especially in the Northeast here, we're dealing with increased heating concerns. Folks may, especially in really frigid temperatures like we've seen in the past month, start to get a little bit creative with how they heat their home, or if things freeze, maybe thawing out pipes in creative ways that might yield an unfortunate fire problem.
So, Prescott, this is one case where creativity is not rewarded.
No. And in fact, we live in a wonderful state where folks, their creativity is, it just runs rampant. But in this case, what we're really asking is that for folks to be safe in their choices. So although it might be a quick fix, to thaw the pipes or heat their home using, a 25-year-old space heater that was handed down from generations, recommendation is to for sure not do that, as we just can't, safety needs to be in people's minds.
Yeah. Now, when being called out on these types of fires in the winter, what are the challenges that you face that you might not at other times of the year?
One of the biggest challenges, as we've just seen from the recent dump of snow, is the navigation challenge. And I don't just mean, the plow operators are fantastic, so the roads are very clear right now. What it is the navigation challenge is once we get on scene. So if we live in a hydranted district, making sure those fire hydrants are cleaned out, all of that time that we take to clean those fire hydrants out is time that's not spent combating that fire. And also logistical challenges that people don't often think about. If there's, 4 feet of snow in their yard piled up or windblown, we need to get access potentially to all sides of their house. And time is truly our enemy when it comes to these fires.
Wow. And when you talk about hydrants, you're talking about access to the hydrant itself, right? So that there's an area around it dug out so you can get to it.
Absolutely, and the same is true in our rural district, not just in Williston, but around the state. A lot of departments rely on rural water supply, and they have something called a dry hydrant, which is an installed system that goes into a static water source like a pond or a river in some cases. Those dry hydrants are equally as beneficial to a wet hydrant that we might have in parts of Williston, also need to be cleaned out if possible.
I'm wondering, too, if you wind up with a lot of your firefighters also who do snow removal who might be out, having to do that as well when a fire call comes in.
Absolutely. We actually, for a number of years, he unfortunately just had to leave. We had a gentleman who did, landscaping, and he and his crew were diligent about, any of the properties that they took care of. Yes, it was an additional time on their plate, but it was time well spent, especially if, God forbid, something, a fire problem were to occur in one of those homes or businesses.
Yeah. All right. So we talked about the challenges of getting to the fire. How are response times affected, in the winter? How much longer will it take to get to a rural location in the winter than it does at other times of the year?
We have found already just in a number of fire responses or near fire responses in the town of Williston, recent dump of snow was one thing, but also we can't forget that, a number of times when ice blanketed our roadways. So not only is there the time it takes from when we leave our fire station to when we arrive on the scene, but something else we have to consider is the time, not every fire department in the state of Vermont, in fact, most fire departments in the state of Vermont do not have have career staffing. So we have to consider the fact that firefighters all over the state are responding from home to the station, which is additional, not only added time, but also danger for those responders as they're traveling through snow and icy conditions to get to the station, then get into their apparatus to respond to the scene.
Mm. And have fire departments faced the same kind of staffing shortages that other businesses have?
Rick, it is so unfortunate because it does transcend across businesses and, in this case, the fire and emergency medical services industry. We are in the process of seeking applicants to fill what we hope to be 9 positions. And although we have a decent candidate pool, the reality of it is, until we get those 9 folks in the door, we can't really predict what will happen. I can tell you also from a volunteer standpoint, volunteerism is notably down to an arguably critical level when we're talking about getting folks in the door. People drive by fire stations all the time, and I think they assume that when the 911 call comes in, a fire truck or an ambulance is going to show up. And although that is often true, it might show up with 1 person or 2 people, which in the world of a structure fire or a cardiac arrest in EMS is not nearly enough.
Mm. So let's talk about how people can aid firefighters in aiding response times. Is there anything we can do, the citizens can do, to help you?
Oh, absolutely, and I'm thankful for that question because any listeners out there, I'll start with an easy one but with a little bit of a twist. So listeners are probably going to say, oh, man, I've heard so much about, carbon monoxide detectors and smoke detectors.
Right.
The reality of it is the general message is that time is our enemy, and if there are smoke and CO detectors that activate and a 911 call can come in early, that is all time saved that allows the fire department to get on the road faster and to your barn, to your home, to your business faster. So, Rick, the twist I'm going to put on this is instead of just reminding folks to check their detectors and make sure they're working and on every level of the home, I want people to consider looking in when they replace their detectors, if they go bad or if you're looking to, get into a new home or whatnot, how about a detector that reports to either an alarm company or to your cell phone? Everybody has cell phones these days, and there are detectors out there that are approximately these days the same price as a hardwired detector that reports straight to your phone.
Well, yeah, it seems we can do everything by phone. So, why wouldn't that be something that we could hook up? Is that very difficult to get done?
No, and in fact, a lot of these systems don't even require an electrician to be hired. In the vein of some of the hardwired systems, that is our recommendation. But a lot of these systems, like I said, not only cost-wise, are they in the same ballpark as some of these hardwired detectors, but picture this. You're out at the supermarket, you're on a vacation, any number of situations where you are outside of your home, and Lord knows what could be occurring, but if your smoke and CO detector goes off, instantaneous alert to your phone, you don't even need to think about it. Some of these systems actually allow you to call 911 with a simple, push of a button right from their app.
Hmm. All right. Excellent advice. Now, are there things that we can do at the site before you all arrive? And, of course, still remain safe.
Yes. Yeah. And I thank you, Rick, because the number one priority is, of course, occupant safety. So when an alarm does go off, whether it be in a business or your home, we really ask that people, get out of the house as quickly and safely as possible with one very critical caveat. We're asking people to remember to close their door. That could be the front door to their home as they evacuate the home. If the fire occurs in a bedroom or in a utility room, anything like that, please try your darndest to close those doors. That is going to buy us as the firefighters critical time to put that fire out. It's going to, in essence, contain it to whatever room that is.
Well, explain why closing doors is such a big deal. I mean, would I close a garage door? What's the point?
So here's a crazy statistic for you. They've done some studies from this. There's a website called closeyourdoor.org. It's about this program, Close Before You Doze. In other words, close the bedroom door when you go to sleep, with the safety factor of if something were to occur, you would be even more protected. The reason it's important is because studies have shown that in a bedroom with the door closed, and a fire occurring in the hallway or in the home outside, the temperatures were rated in about the 100-degree mark. A bedroom immediately adjacent with the door open, the temperatures were over 1,000 degrees, which, as we know, is just not survivable. So picture that same temperature concept with parts per million of carbon monoxide. Much more, 1,000 parts per million in a door that has a bedroom door that's closed. 10,000 was rated or read as a reading in the open door.
Hmm. And with an open door, would that supply more oxygen to the fire, if I left an outside door open?
Absolutely. And that is why you had mentioned a garage door or the front door to the home. Again, people hopefully don't experience fire problems ever in their life. But if they do, just taking that extra few seconds to close that door, it's going to reduce toxic smoke levels, improve oxygen levels for victims that might be trapped in the home, but reduce that oxygen that's, that is able to increase the fire, spread the fire.
Yeah, they love fire, they love oxygen, those fires. Mm. Prescott, what kinds of things should we be thinking about to prevent fires in the first place at this time of year?
A great question, and a few really simple things. I know we're well sort of into the Vermont winter here, but it's never too late to have your chimney or wood stove inspected by a professional. I know a lot of folks, we had talked earlier in the program, a lot of folks have a DIY mindset that I 100% support. Just make sure every once in a while, maybe it'd be every other year, you do hire the professional to come in and perform an inspection. We've seen a number of fires this year already in wood stoves and chimneys that a simple inspection would have prevented the fire from spreading.
What about space heaters? Why are they such a cause of these fires?
And unfortunately for the listeners who might be well aware of a tragic fire that occurred earlier this year in New York City, where a number of fatalities occurred because of a faulty space heater, and was exacerbated by the fact that the door to the apartment was left open, causing smoke to travel 19 floors. But space heaters, at the end of the day, we're asking folks to make sure that they have an automatic shutoff if it were to tip over. A critical component, if they don't have that shutoff, is to make sure that there's a minimum 3-foot radius around that space heater to make sure that no flammable objects, accidents happen. But if you have that 3-foot barrier around that space heater, it'll still provide the heat everyone needs, but also in a very safe manner.
What about something like furnace filters?
Making sure that, and again, so that goes back to that sort of preventative maintenance.
Right.
I look also furnace filters. I look at dryer vent cleaning.
Oh, yeah.
These are preventative maintenance tips that if folks, I hope the listeners aren't saying, oh, gosh, I've heard the safety message so much, because I can't say it enough. Because if we impact one listener who says, man, I'm going to leave, this program or hop on the phone to schedule an inspection for my furnace, get some of my equipment PM'd to make sure that it is in proper working order. Imagine the savings, both financial savings, but also potential life savings if you avoid a catastrophic fire simply by doing some preventative maintenance ahead of time.
Now, I had a high school friend. Her father was a fire chief, made her have a fire extinguisher in her car. It was always tough sitting in the back seat of that car. But how important are fire extinguishers in the home and the barn, and how often should they be checked?
So an annual inspection of the fire extinguisher is in businesses authorized. We, you know, if it's a residential, you can actually get by with checking, you know, basically doing a visual inspection to make sure that it's at the appropriate pressure and that the you know, any tube or opening where the product comes out is clear of debris. Those type of general inspections, it's not sort of rusting out, hasn't been there for 30 years. Fire extinguishers are a wonderful tool and can actually prevent a fire from the incipient stage growing into that, you know, fully developed stage when you really it's an untenable situation. Yep. But again, in the vein of safety, while fire extinguishers are a wonderful tool to have, a fire has to be very small for folks, should be very small for folks to try to combat it on their own. Gotcha. Firefighters have, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of personal protective equipment designed to keep us safe. Civilians in the middle of the night when most fires statistically or when many fires occur, rather, are maybe just, you know, wearing no personal protective equipment at all.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a call from Ted, who joins us from Shelburne. Hey, Ted. How you doing?
Hi. Doing fine. And this will be quick, but I just wanted to comment. I heard about making sure there was space around the electric space heaters. And I had an experience with an older electric heater that I was just using in the bathroom, and it was never untended. But feel the cord all the way to the plug. Because mine apparently had, just from some age, it had a weak spot in the wire, which made it become heater in itself. And I was getting a hot receptacle and a hot cord. And so, in addition to what was mentioned with the safety with an electric heater, is to realize it is drawing a lot of electricity and make sure that it's not on a flimsy extension cord, and make sure that even the heavy cord that came with it is staying cool all the way to and including the receptacle.
All right.
I think that'll be it, but it's relevant on that. Also, watching this throwing away ashes on the porch, if that's been mentioned. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ted. Yeah, two great points, Prescott.
Those are fantastic points, and I appreciate that, because just to talk very briefly, to reiterate the absolute safety message of no extension cords whatsoever with space heaters, Ted did a fantastic job mentioning the fact that even the cord, the heavy-duty cord that comes with the space heater and should be plugged directly into the wall like his, can have those malfunctions, which is why it's so important, like he did, to check that and say, my goodness, I have a problem that I need to remedy. And just a quick note on the clearing of the ashes, you know, into the metal receptacle. A lot of folks do make the mistake of putting that too close to, you know, on the porch or too close to a home. And we've had fires, catastrophic fires, not just in the town of Williston, but around Vermont, that have started on a porch, and folks don't know about it until that fire is extending into their home, which again goes back to adequate smoke and carbon monoxide detectors, so we can know, the homeowners can know early on, can get out of that house, and can get the emergency responders on the road so fast.
Prescott, once firefighters arrive, what should the property owners do? What should they tell firefighters? Where should they go?
Oh, that's it. These questions are so good. The most important thing that we are looking for, when I show up at the scene of a structure fire, I have a lot on my mind.
Right.
The number one priority when I get out of that truck is life safety. And that is the life safety of those occupants. They are number one in our book. So we're going to try to find anybody on the scene. So the best thing that residents can do is find the first arriving firefighters and tell them, you know, what the situation is. I was able to escape with my family. We are all out of the home. I believe the fire is located in this area. Now, I don't want people searching around their home if there's smoke filling it. At that point, we are just looking for a report of whether or not everybody is out of the home.
Mm-hmm. At what point do you call in other fire companies?
Oh, so we in Williston, we have a really robust mutual aid matrix. And the reason for that is we don't want to strip any one community of all of their fire resources. So we'll call an engine out of one district, a ladder out of another, an ambulance from a third. But we call a lot of resources early. You know, folks will see a media report from us that says, oh, we called 9 fire departments for a single residents.
Right.
And my goodness, why do you need 9 fire departments? Well, like I said, with the staffing, if 9 fire departments, each truck shows up with, you know, 2 or 3 people on it, we still barely have the full complement of resources that the National Fire Protection Association recommends for a low hazard structural fire, which is 15 firefighters within the first 8 minutes. Just picture that.
Wow. All right. So you mentioned earlier shortages in staffing in fire departments. So what should someone do if they'd like to pursue a professional or volunteer career in firefighting?
It's a fantastic question, and no matter where you find yourself listening from, the car in Montpelier, Williston, you know, even out of state for Pete's sake, if you have an interest, if you have a passion and want to help your community, reach out to your local fire department. And if you're not getting a response there because, again, they're not necessarily all staffed, then perhaps reach out if you can find a local career department. You know, I know us in the town of Williston are more than happy to offer a ride-along if somebody's interested in checking out what life is like in the fire service as a career staff member. There are educational programs that are being spun up in the state to help people out. Emergency medical technicians, we've talked a lot of fire, but EMTs are drastically needed, and that course is about a semester long. Just reach out to your local fire or EMS agency, and I'll be sure to get my contact information out there. Folks just have I would be more than happy to answer some questions.
Excellent. Prescott Natto is a fire captain with the Williston Fire Department. Prescott, thanks so much for your helpful guidance this morning.
My pleasure, Rick.
All right. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to open up the phones until 11 o'clock this morning. Coming up today at 4, we've got the afternoon news service with Brady Farkas, followed by the Brady Farkas Show up until 6:45. Then it's high school boys basketball. Brent Curtis calling the Randolph at Spalding game. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back. This is Vermont Viewpoint, and right now we've got the phones open. 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. We talked seafood this morning, so your favorite seafood that you like or recipes you'd like to share. You can call in, let us know. I've got one I just poached from a place in the Hamptons for savory seafood chili that I'll share with you in a little bit. We talked with Frankie Allen, another WDEV All-Star. Is there someone who I haven't gotten to yet who you'd like to hear from, one of the voices of the past from WDEV? Let's see. We talked fire safety. Any tips you'd like to share? And if you missed yesterday during the 10 o'clock hour, we had Marty Gitlin was on talking about the 100 greatest cartoon characters. Any you'd like to share that you love? One that came in late, Cindy mentioned Mr. Magoo. I loved him. First of all, he was blind. He'd wear these glasses he couldn't see, and he'd bump into things, and everything he would interpret incorrectly, he'd be mumbling there, and he'd walk around with his umbrella. Very funny, Cindy. That was a great one. One other thing, the news about Ryan Cochran Siegel picking up a silver in Beijing. And boy, I'd love to hear from Barbara Ann Cochran this morning. I don't know. I always want to talk to her every time Ryan does something great. But how great is that? He wins a silver almost 50 years to the day that his mother won the gold. Isn't that incredible? Oh, I love it so much. I came down I-89 this morning after I heard the news about Ryan, and there it is. Off to my right is Cochran's. I can see the hills, and I don't know. It just felt even more special, like it was glowing, shimmering over there because Ryan had just won silver in the Olympics. Oh, man, I love it. All right, our numbers are 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can always email us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And let's start in Cabot and go to Michael. Hi, Michael, what's up?
So, cartoon-wise, He-Man and She-Ra.
Oh, yeah. He-Man and She-Ra. Yeah. Now that
they were early 80s, I think.
Right, right. So they were probably just as I was aging out. I just missed them, so I never really watched them. What was special about He-Man and She-Ra?
They just were dynamic together. I don't know. They melded well together.
I love it.
And then, of course, we got Garfield.
Oh, yeah, Garfield.
Of course, he was more interesting in his books, I think, than he is on the TV.
Ate a lot of lasagna, that cat, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And then, so swordfish, speaking of food,
yes,
I like to do an Italian marinated swordfish, yeah, which is just some olive oil, some red wine vinegar, a little bit of marjoram,
yep,
which is a lot like basil, but it's a little sweeter, and then just a little salt.
Oh, nice.
And I think as a guest, you could potentially get Anson Tebbets to tell you some Cabot stories someday, crossing over back to your tours.
I have had Anson. You probably missed him, so you're going to have to listen to the podcast. But he was a great guest. Yeah, that's a great suggestion, and he was actually a great guest to have on. Really,
yeah, his mother was really good friends with my grandmother. So
oh, no kidding.
There's a little family tie there as well, yeah.
Oh, wow. So. Yeah, he is great on the air. I mean, he still does, obviously, for the birds, but it was great having him on. I think that was probably early December that I was able to get Anson.
Yeah, I think I probably caught it, but I think I caught it.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
All right,
great
have a good afternoon. Yep.
All right, take care. He-Man and She-Ra. There we go. And Garfield. Don't forget Garfield. All right, let's go to the Duke of Newbury. Fred is next. Hey, Fred, what's going on?
Oh, this is interesting. This 26th Amendment is very interesting. What happened was when Woodrow Wilson was the president of the United States, he had a stroke, and there was no constitutional way to replace him. In other words, the vice president never took over when Woodrow Wilson became sick. His wife did. She was running the country for 2 years. And so in 1965, they ratified the 25th Amendment. The states ratified the 25th Amendment and made it law.
Wow.
And they needed it. So, and the whole thing boils down to, if a president becomes disabled right now and he has to go to the hospital, the vice president automatically takes over until the president is ready to serve again. And if the cabinet and the vice president feel in a unanimous vote, only have to be by one, if the president is unfit for any reason, they can eliminate the president of the United States. He can be forced out, and you can have a palace coup.
Interesting. Now, the vice president at the time who didn't get to take over was Thomas Marshall.
I didn't know who he was.
Yeah, I had to look it up. Thomas Marshall. And now Woodrow had two wives, but I'm going to guess that it was the second one, which was Edith Wilson.
Yes.
the president we never heard of, we'll call her.
That's right. That's
How about that?
Yeah, right.
The first female president of the United States.
Yeah, she ran the executive office, I think they said, for about 2 years.
Oh, I love it.
And then in 65, of course, they had to change this because there's no constitutional regulations. Right now, if a president becomes disabled, then the vice president can temporarily take over until a president can get back on his feet.
Right.
And this happens quite frequently if they have to go to the hospital for some sort of surgery or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and then there's Ollie North. Remember when he took over? So he was, I think it was when President Reagan, for some reason, he was out of the country, and maybe Vice President Bush was, I don't know, incapacitated, but Ollie North said he was in charge.
It was somebody else. It wasn't him. He was a general. I can't remember what his name was.
Okay.
He said he was in charge.
Right, right. Yeah, that happens too. Talk about a military coup. All right, thanks, Fred. Great to hear from the Duke of Newbury. Let's move on to Randolph Center. Mary, you're up. How you doing, Mary?
Hey, Rick. I'm good. I too loved Mr. Magoo. Anybody mentioned Yogi Bear?
There were some Yogi
and Boo Boo.
Yogi and Boo Boo and Mr. Park Ranger, sir. Yep.
Loved that.
Yep.
And my kids love the Smurfs.
Yeah, now nobody mentioned the Smurfs. There was one Smurf on the list that Marty did, you know, in his book of the 100, but it wasn't Papa Smurf. That's who I thought would have been the most popular.
Oh, maybe it was Smurfette.
No, it wasn't Smurfette either. It was like Jokey Smurf. Do you remember Jokey Smurf?
Oh, Jokey.
Jokey Smurf made the list, but no Papa and no Smurfette. I was a little surprised, but the Smurfs, yeah, they were very popular, and that was just as I was aging out too of cartoons, unfortunately. So I didn't get the full, you know, love of Smurfs that I should have, but they
that's
did.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
How about the Jetsons?
Oh yeah, now Judy Jetson and Jane and, you know, Elroy, Astro, Ruh-Roh, the Flintstones.
You mentioned the Flintstones.
Yeah, so Marty did at one point, and I think he mentioned it in the context that they were on primetime. At one point, yeah, the Flintstones and the Jetsons were on primetime TV, and they were great stuff. He did mention that the Flintstones were based on the Honeymooners, you know, the old Jackie Gleason and Art Carney TV show. And as a matter of fact, he said that they took some of the storylines directly from the Honeymooners show. It'd be great, you know. What are we going to write about this week for the Flintstones? I don't know. Go find an old Honeymooners episode. And sure enough, they would just, you know, yeah. But, yeah.
Oh, God.
Nothing was better than watching Fred, you know, with those big feet power his car.
Yeah.
You know, that's how he'd move the car. Yeah. You'd have the whole family in there. And then in the intro, they'd pull up for, like, brontosaurus ribs. Remember that? They put that on the side of his car and it would fall over. Yeah.
Tip over, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Rick,
great stuff.
I'll see you Thursday.
Oh, good. You're coming to Ken's Barbershop.
I may.
All right. Thanks, Mary. Mary,
okay,
reminding
bye.
Everyone that this Thursday, 2 days from now, I'll be doing the next WDEV 90th anniversary on the road. Ken's Barbershop in Randolph, right downtown. Got the, I think it's a catamount, stuffed in the window, and we'll be there from 9 to 11. All right, let's take a break. Come back with a few more minutes of open phones. You can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We've got phones open until 11. Talking about favorite seafood or seafood recipes, WDEV All-Stars, fire prevention tips, favorite cartoon characters. If you'd like to join in, we're at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or VTViewpoint at RadioVermont.com. Let's clear up a few things first. when Fred was talking and we mentioned the guy who seized power said he was in charge. I said Ollie North. I was wrong. Fred was right that I was wrong, but he couldn't come up with the name. Either we had a caller tell us, General Al Haig, Alexander Haig, took charge. Yes, indeed, he did. All right. The de facto president. We also had a suggestion for a WDEV All-Star interview, Brian Joyce. He is on my list, and I will get Brian on here at some point, so thanks for that suggestion. All right, let's see. Who do we have? Oh, we got a caller from Montpelier. Let's go to Jerry. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. We're getting to spring, so that's good.
Yes, we are getting to spring. That's a very optimistic viewpoint. I like that.
I've lived in Vermont for 66 years, so yeah, you got to be optimistic.
Exactly. We're getting to spring. I love it.
You know, it's still February, but.
And days get a little longer each
year. I heard
shorter.
You're talking about old DEV guys. They're not all.
Yes,
old,
yes.
Some are down the road now.
Uh-huh.
And one is, which I might have missed it. You might have had him on. But Mr. Noyes.
Oh, Johnny Noyes.
Yeah.
No, we haven't had John on.
Well, I'd like to hear what he's up to. And I'd like, you know, he used to be George Como's, like, color man
yeah.
at the Norwich games.
Yep, he's, he did mornings
and
here
he
for
always
years,
dropped
right?
in news at the go to the dump by. And
that's right.
I miss him.
All right, we'll try to scare up John Noyes. I know he's on another station not too far away, but I think he's doing mornings, so I think he'd be done by time we go on the air. I think I could get John on. Yeah.
Yep, that'd be great.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for that suggestion.
Just don't tell him I called about it.
Oh, I'm outing you. I'm going to tell him, hey, Jerry said we had to get you on or he's going to stop listening.
Oh, he'll laugh. He'll laugh. He'll know exactly right. who you're talking about.
Excellent.
He gave me a fan of the game one time at Norwich, at the Norwich hockey game.
Yeah.
And that was great. Because I went downstairs and took a picture with the team and stuff like that.
Oh, nice.
So it was fun.
Oh, well done, Jerry. All right. Thanks for that suggestion. All right, we're at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Now, I mentioned a recipe, and we heard from Mary a little earlier. She's the one who gave me the hoisin sauce ribs. I made them with, what did I do, spare ribs. But the short ribs, that was an excellent recipe. But this one, I stole from somewhere. I saw it, might have been in the, Boston Globe Sunday magazine, but there's a place in the Hamptons called Lobster Roll. It's also known as Lunch because their sign, it has a big lunch sign. And so people call it Lunch. It is for savory seafood chili. And I try not to bore you too much, but so some of the basics, olive oil, Vidalia onion, garlic cloves, diced celery, and then red wine, diced tomatoes, seafood stock, red kidney beans, and cannellini beans, and then some a teaspoon each of chili powder, cumin, and oregano. Then you'll need a half pound of lobster cut into large pieces. They say the claw and knuckle works best. 3/4 of a pound of small shrimp. If you're using larger shrimp, then dice it into smaller pieces. And then a half pound of sea scallops cut into quarters. And, I mean, I know this makes me want to point the car right down to the valley and get to Sugarfish right now and pick up some of that seafood. And I have most of the things I need at home. I could just buy a few things and be ready to make this. Anyway, once you cook it, you know, it tells you how to cook it. Then you top it at the end with cheddar cheese and you melt that. And then you can add sour cream and scallions. How delicious does that sound? That is a savory seafood chili. And the one thing I learned over in Ireland, you think of Ireland and their traditional dishes as corned beef and cabbage, which, you know, is, don't get me wrong. But the one thing you can find in pubs all around Ireland, because think of it, you know, it's an island completely surrounded by water. So they have seafood, you know, just inches away from just about everywhere except, you know, deep in the heart of Ireland. But you pop into a pub at any time of the day and they always have a delicious seafood chowder going. You get a nice big coarse piece of bread and, of course, a Guinness. And that's it, man. That is one of the heartiest, most wonderful meals you'll ever have. And this kind of reminds me of this. Now, they usually do a fish chowder, you know, so they're not going to have the lobster and the shrimp and the scallops. But it's similar base to it. And then they throw in different fish, and it is so good. I don't know if anyone's been to Ireland. Honestly, now Scotland is my place. I belong in Vermont and Scotland. They're the two places on this earth where I feel most at home. But I will tell you that the Irish treat you better when you go to visit them than anyone in the world. And I'm not putting anybody else down. I always have wonderful times wherever I travel. But the Irish feel like – they make you feel like you came to see them specifically. You go into some small Irish town and they cannot believe that some American who has no tie to Ireland – I have no Irish heritage and they have to do something for you, have to give you something. I could bore you – and I was only there once for 10 days. I could probably fill up, you know, 7 weeks with stories from what happened in Ireland. I always have to cut myself off when I start going. But it is a friendly, beautiful place. And, of course, fish chowder in every pub that you can you know, find over there. You'll love it. All right, so that should do it today. Danny, I want you to flip that big switch that knocks off the power to our high-tech phone system. That is a wrap for today. You got Danny taking care of business. All right. Ron Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. And please feel free to suggest guests, topics. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. You can subscribe to it, too, and get it delivered to your inbox, your email, every single day. The WDEV podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is next. That's followed by the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. It's right after CBS News at noon. I'm Rick Sengary. I will meet you back here tomorrow when we visit Mad River Fiber Arts. We're going to learn how to help our avian friends in need in the winter. And we'll also learn about a play at Norwich University about reintegration into civilian life. That's tomorrow.